Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Proudly sponsored by Carryout, Ireland's leading independent off-licence. Carryout.ie.
McCarthy and Jean Smullen, who return once again for Movies and Booze. Good afternoon
Hello,
to you both.
How are you?
How are you?
We are talking about kind of Irish connected wines today, Jean.
We are indeed. Yeah. We are indeed. And I also thought I'd talk a little bit about, as we know, we've had a wonderful summer, and I was talking to David Dennison, who has a vineyard in Waterford, about what sort of harvest it's going to be. So I thought we might have a look at that as well.
Because, okay.
You know, obviously we've had a lot of sunshine, so.
And is that going to make a distinct difference?
It is actually, but not in the way you might think.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What way?
Yeah. Well, David told me that the vines are actually suffering from heat stress, so he's going to have very good harvest. But it's actually going to be, you know, it's not going to be a big harvest. It's going to be a very good harvest, but it's not going to be a very big one.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I suppose he would have planted vines for the Irish weather, and too much sun is terrible news.
There's about 3 or 4 vineyards in Ireland, and they all use either clonal grapes or hybrid grapes, right? And the most famous is a grape called Rondo, which was originally invented in Germany in 1964 and was first planted commercially in Ireland in the 90s, right? And it's, you know, these grapes are specifically designed for marginal climates, because the grape will only grow between 30 degrees north and 50 degrees north. Now, David's in Waterford, which is on a latitude of about 51 degrees. Mm. So if you bring that across, it's on the same sort of latitude as Suffolk or the East Coast, the South Downs, where they're making commercially really, really good sparkling wines and many other wines in England. But the problem is it's sunshine. We just don't. The Gulf Stream keeps our climate to the degree that we don't suffer from bad frosts, but it's too cloudy. And as you know, I'm in Gout there at the moment. It's as humid as hell. So it's called what they call blight weather. And that's going to cause the grapes to develop molds and rot, basically. So what you need is sunshine to actually ripen the grapes. At the moment we're not getting enough of it, but this year we have. But unfortunately, because there's so little water, so little rain, his vines are suffering from heat stress.
Oh God, that's
so
ironic,
you just can't
isn't it?
Win.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is highly ironic.
But you know, I mean, as I say, there's David Llewellyn in Luskin, County Dublin, and there's a brand new vineyard in Watergrass Hill, a small experimental vineyard which has just recently started planting grapes. So, and there's a few people out in the west of Ireland as well. So, you know, Irish wine growing is small, it's marginal, but it's getting there. And I would say, hopefully, you know, heat stress notwithstanding, and we've had been getting a bit of rain in the last couple of weeks. I hope they all end up having a great vintage.
Miriam wants to know, could you please ask your wine expert for some advice? If we travel to France by boat, we always bring home some wine, which we usually source in local supermarkets. We usually drink red, but I always pick up a few white as well. Last year, we were in the Ile de Ré and picked up a few boxes from various regions. However, when we got home, one of the white wines turned out to be the Nectar of the Gods, but we forgot to note the label. We are returning there this year and to the Basque country. And while I know everyone's Nectar of the Gods is different, any suggestions for some red and whites to assist in our quest? Well, that's a long story there,
that's
but Basque
story.
Country there, you're thinking.
And the problem is that even though she bought the wine in the supermarket, it may not have been from that Basque region. It could have been from anywhere in France.
Yeah.
I mean, just as you go into a supermarket here and the wines come from all over the world, you know. The Basque country does produce wine, but more on the Spanish side than on the French side, you know. So,
right, yeah.
On the Spanish side, it's Rioja Taxoli is the name of the region. I have been to the French side of the Basque region, which is kind of around Biarritz and that part of the world, and they don't really produce a hell of a lot of wine. You'd have to go a little bit further inland, and actually not that far from where one of our red wines from Fronton, which is where one of our wines today. But Spanish Basque region does have wine, but the French Basque region doesn't. So I would imagine what happened is, she bought that, and it could have come from somewhere within the locality, but not specifically the Basque region. And the moral of the story is take a picture on your phone the next time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
But so specifically, if they're looking for Basque wines, you're looking at the Spanish side.
Is probably your best bet. Yeah.
Off to Girona next week for a few days. Any good local wines to try? Michael wants to know.
To where?
Girona. I assume there's Girona in Italy.
Italy. Yeah. I've no idea. Genoa. Yeah.
Girona's in Spain.
Sorry, is it? Yeah, G-I-R-O-N-E,
it's on the it's on that side, the same side as Barcelona.
Oh, okay, well then you're in Penedès country. And yeah. I mean, the only winery, the big, most famous winery from that part of the world is Torres. So,
Jeez, you can get that here.
Yeah, you can get that here, but yeah.
Get a few cans of Heineken, Michael.
There's actually a very good Spanish region that's just a bit to the north of Penedès called Priorat. And there's a lot of very, very good wine coming out of that area, you know, sort of innovative, made from young, fashionable winemakers. So try Priorat wines.
Right. So the two wines we are talking about today, you did mention the red one.
What we're going to look at is the Sump Jump, which is Darrenburg, which is Australian. And there's an Irish connection there in that Chester's granny came from, or granny's ancestors came from Ireland. And there's a fun story about that. And the other one is Chateau Bellevue Lafroy, which is owned by an Irishman, Philip Grant, who I actually had lunch with. God, it was 2010. I was just thinking, gosh, it's nearly 8 years ago. And he's one of the, the Irish people who actually owns a vineyard abroad, one of what we call the wine geese. So I reviewed one of his wines many years ago, his rosé, but I thought we'd look at the Bellevue Lafroy today. And it's made from an interesting grape called Negrette.
Okay. Not one I've heard of before. And that's always actually interesting when you bring in wines or particularly a grape we're not familiar with. So the two movies today, Ant-Man, I suppose, is the big one of the two.
Absolutely, yeah. Ant-Man and the Wasp, the latest Marvel in a season of Marvels. We've had a lot of them in the last year. But they're distinguishing themselves from each other, I think. That's what I'm kind of starting to like about them. Especially, I think, Taika Waititi's take on Thor.
It was great.
Ragnarok was great. Yeah. It had its own identity and personality. And this one is the same, really. Ant-Man is, it's Marvel light, I would say. It's there's not a lot of tension or drama, and maybe after just witnessing what happened at the end of the latest Avengers movie, it's okay to have what my friend Joe would call a palate cleanser. Palate cleanser Marvel is this one. And Paul Rudd is a great physical comedian, and he's allowed kind of go a bit mad here, so it's a whole lot of fun.
But is it the way they're all connected into the same story arc, and they're meeting, bumping into Spider-Man down the down.
There's less
super
of
value,
that in
kind of
this
thing.
One, but yeah, you do get the post credits thing, and then I think you get the post credits thing.
Oh, crazy.
And they do pop in and out of each other's films. But this feels more like a standalone. It's more of a sequel, really. It's more like Captain America's style situation, where they're kind of sequels to their own predecessors.
Okay, and who is the Wasp?
The Wasp is Evangeline Lilly, who gets to be centre stage here. She's a first proper female superhero to feature in the title of a Marvel film.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a step in the right direction.
Okay,
it's
now,
also about
because this
time.
Is like where I get it. Wonder Woman isn't Marvel then. She's the other.
Wonder
She's
Woman
DC, is
DC. Exactly.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So released by Warner. Marvel's movies are all released by Disney. Most of them.
Never heard of the Wasp, actually.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
She's
good. She's a good character. It's like Ant-Man. The fun here is in the changing of size continually, and they really go for the laughs with that one here, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other film is Apostasy. I think we actually did interview the fella who.
Oh really? Did you?
Yeah. Who wrote the? I don't know if he wrote the script, but it was based on his kind of personal story.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm guessing that would be the director then, and it's a guy called Daniel Cotto-Tito.
Yes, yeah.
A very interesting man. First feature. We're going full art house in this one because it's August, and frankly, I can't say much more about spandex at this stage. And it's nice to have a bit of counter programming and find something a little bit different. So this is an art house. You'll have to go looking for this one. It's kind of on limited release, but it is a super film. It's about a family of Jehovah's Witnesses. And circumstances which lead one or two of the family to question their fate and doubt their fate, and whether that will then, cause them to be ostracized from their family or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really brilliantly acted three-hander, which with all female characters in the leads, actually. And it's not often you'll see a film that's 100% Rotten Tomatoes. But this
wow,
one is
okay.
100% positive reviews. Yeah,
right. That's extraordinary. Mm. Someone says, I went to see Mamma Mia 2 during the week. What a load of tripe. Cher is barely in it. The performances were flat and the storyline could have been written by a 5-year-old. Are they missing the point of Mamma Mia? by bringing any of those criticisms to bear?
I would say it's no Schindler's List, nor is it meant to be.
No.
And I would say it's doing massive box office here. Absolutely massive. Took 800,000 on its opening weekend and hasn't fallen much in terms of percentages since, which is a real sign that it's a good word of mouth film.
Yeah.
Or that people are returning to see it a second time.
It's just got a thing to it that you enjoy that thing or you don't.
Yeah. I thought it was better than the first film. And we likened it to The Godfather Part 2 last week when we were saying that. being mischievous as ever. But I think I like something that makes people so happy. I think it's kind of like...
What's wrong with it? Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
I'd like if they had better vocalists in the cast though. And I think the addition of Lily James in this one, who plays the young Meryl Streep and gives you that whole backstory, was really inspired actually, because it gives the film new legs. I could see this going Fast and Furious. I could see it's getting a Mamma Mia movie every summer.
Yeah, and until The Rock actually does appear in it.
Yeah.
The hashtag is canned movies from the Stuff That Changes What We Did During the Week, Into the John West, as many others as well. We did get a question in from someone who said they found a case of wine. It was the Nectar of the Gods and then they couldn't remember the name of it. Muriel says, how did she drink a whole case of wine and not remember the name? Think you've answered your old question there, Muriel. 1890-453-106 is our low call number. Our text number is 53106. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. Jean and Esther are with us for Movies and Booze. We did get a question already from someone who was going to be this year going to the Basque Country. A couple of people have sent in largely the same answer. I think that person had wine from... Now, they're going to the Basque Country this time, so I don't think they've had wine from the Basque Country yet. But anyway, they recommend Urulagay. I think that's how you pronounce it.
That's the name of the region. Yeah.
It was amazing. We had the red one. We cannot source it ever since, but it was the best. There's also... someone else says same thing. There's a well-known red in French Basque Country, girl. Urulagay, super. Also, the wine geese title is only applied to the Irish chieftains who fled Ireland after the Battle of Kinsale and settled in France, says Margaret.
They weren't in fact chieftains. Most of them, actually, it was after the 1798 rebellion, and an awful lot of them were just merchants who went over with a very good business acumen and started their own businesses in Bordeaux, and, you know, then married into some of the families who owned a lot of land and then were given titles, you know. So they went up the social ladder over a couple of generations. So they are the, you know, there's a great book by a guy called Ted Murphy, who did a television program as well for RTE back in the 80s called The Wine Geese. And the book is called The Kingdom of Wine. Now, it's not in print at the moment, but I'm sure you get it if you Google it. And, he, you know, Ted actually is a historian who wrote a really interesting history about it all. So, yeah, it's a slightly different story.
Well, I suppose the version there is kind of more romantic,
and
really,
Uruguay, you won't see an awful lot of the wines. And actually, it's predominantly a white wine region. It's next door to another region called Yuranson, where they make some very good white wines there that you do see on the market here. And the sort of grapes around the area are Gros Mansang and Petit Mansang for the whites. So yeah, they're small, lesser known, and when, you know, again, you never stop learning the wine trade, and I had forgotten about them. So yeah, Uruguay is a wine region that's just, it's southwest France, just marginally on the Basque region area.
Somebody also asked about Girona. We were near Girona last September. We got a gorgeous local ratafia called La Prodessa. Best way ever to finish a dinner. They say that sounds like that it might
it
be
says,
a dessert
might
wine
be, or a fortified
or a
wine of some kind.
Yeah,
yeah. Or Rafafia, probably it's a straw rye wine, which means that the grapes are dried before they're crushed and fermented.
Oh.
So there's a lot of residual sugar in the wine.
Right. The person who slated Mamma Mia 2 needs more joy in their life. Next, they'll say they thought Paddington was underwhelming. They want to see a joyful explosion of music and dance. They're not going to a classic noir, for God's sake. There's somebody else says, I agree, Mamma Mia is trite. People are going because they think it's going to be good. The male voices are very weak. Young Donna is so painfully annoying. Yes, I sang along, but it was weak. The script spoon-feeding the story to the audience. Is it even important that that there's no major singers in it? Because my impression of it wouldn't be my cup of tea, but that you didn't feel as bad about singing along because the people you're singing along to weren't, you know, were on your own level.
Yes,
you know what I mean.
And Universal later, with the first film, later released a sing-along of Mamma Mia for that very purpose. probably
and I suppose
do
it
so
was called
one.
A sing-alonga.
I'm sure it was. I can't remember. But I don't... Referring to that text, I don't know how anyone could feel cheated going into this film. That's for sure. I mean, its core audience know what they're getting. It certainly doesn't shortchange in that regard. I would say it's a better made film than the first one, actually. And there's a lot of professionalism from all involved. Except for some of the singing is just...
It's just dire.
See,
yes.
I'm a huge ABBA fan. I think they're musical geniuses and I think their songs are actually very profound. I will use that word. I'm a huge ABBA fan. So it upsets my ears to hear them.
So you're actually precious about what kind of
I'm
ABBA music you
ABBA,
hear.
That's
an unusual combination, Esther. Well done.
So it upsets my ears to hear them being mangled. So, but the film's a whole lot of fun.
My girlfriend dragged me along to this as she was dying to see it. Horrendous stuff. The singing, the acting, the lot. Amazing. Me and my two kids sang every word from start to finish. Loved it. It's one of those Marmite things.
Absolutely.
Someone wants to know, is there any cheap wine I can pass off as expensive wine to give as a leaving present to the wagon I work with? She's a proper wine snob, so make me look good, please.
Oh God. So you'd be glad to see her going. So.
Yes.
That's the $64 million question. Everybody is looking for the wine that tastes like it costs more. In other words, you spend, but if you're really looking for anything of quality, you've got to spend in the region of about 14 to 20 euro a bottle, right? And there you'll get the sort of quality level where there's interesting wines that are that actually do punch above their weight. But since I've no idea where you are or where you're based, my advice would be go into an independent off license where they have trained staff. Tell them that you want to buy something that, just say, I want something that tastes like it costs more. What can you recommend? And be prepared to pay between 15 and 20 euro.
Yeah. Doesn't sound to me like they like this person that
but
much.
But you know, never you know diss what? Anyone, because I've always found it in the career ladder, somewhere along the line, it could be 10 years, it could be 20 years, that you meet up with them again.
It's true.
And usually they're in a position of great power, so you kind of kick yourself for not being nice to them. So,
or they may be in a position of great power,
could
and
be,
they can wreak their revenge.
Yeah, so be careful there. Buy something decent. You never know when you're going to meet that person again.
Then again, they say that they're a wine snob, which doesn't necessarily mean they know that much. And so if you got them a bottle made of some obscure grape that, you know, that they've never heard of, they won't know whether it's expensive or not.
The thing is, what I always feel about snobbery is it's the people who are snobby are insecure, basically, and they want to prove something to themselves.
Yeah.
So you'll probably find that underneath it all, she's a mental mess, you know, who feels that if she can talk knowledgeably about wine, then, you know, she has some status. So give her a break there, you know.
There's a bit of psychiatry thrown in there as well.
I tell you, get everything on the show.
Will from Tip says, is there anywhere that distributes a wine by San Montano called Alto Valles? On a recent trip to the Pyrenees, we came across this incredible wine in a restaurant. Couldn't find it anywhere for sale.
Yeah, San Montano is one of the upcoming Spanish regions. Again, it's up in the north. It's north of Penedès, around San Montano, Priorat. Those are the sort of the up-and-coming areas. Two things that he said. First of all, he got it in a restaurant, which means usually those
but
the wines
that was in
at
the, in the Alps, though.
Yeah, but even still, the rest there's certain wines that once they're made for restaurants, they stay in restaurants no matter where they're exported to. The other thing is that we don't see a huge amount of San Montano wines here on the Irish market. It's probably unlikely you're going to get it here.
Right. Alan, no, it's horticulture tips you have to give out.
Right.
For the first time, my greenhouse grapes have been infected by a powdery mildew. Probably lose the crop. Anything I can do?
Weed them, yeah. Copper sulfate if you spray with that, but that's what they do in the vineyards, you know. But I don't know if you could do that in a vineyard.
Yeah.
Or sorry, in a greenhouse.
Especially if there's anything else in there. Gemma says, I've always wondered and was hoping you could ask your wine lady, what kind of wine do they use during Mass? Is it expensive? How much wine are they going to have to use for the Pope's Mass in the Phoenix Park and Knock? These are things that keep me awake at night. That's an interesting question, Gemma. I have no idea.
There are companies who specifically produce altar wine, right?
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I don't know what the ins and outs of that are. I know there used to be companies who supplied altar wine. I suspect now, given that parish funds are probably tight like everybody else's, they probably go out and buy something relatively cheap from their local off license like everybody else does.
Is that what they do, I wonder?
I have no idea. I really don't, because I don't know much about it. In fact, I don't know anything about it.
Because you think it's the Pope, like they'll push the boat out a bit, you know.
Well, I you probably have to talk to the diocese and find out what they're going to do.
Yeah, if anyone knows. But I think you're right. I think it's specific, like it's like bottles with altar wine written on them.
Yeah, that would be my understanding. They probably bulk buy, you know, so or they get a deal.
Right,
I have no idea.
What's our first wine today,
Jay?
Okay,
our first wine is the 2017 The Stump Jump, and it's a Sauvignon Blanc from Australia. Retails at $15.99. You'll get it in carryout and in independent off licenses nationwide. Now, I love the story of this particular wine. Chester Osborne is one of the great personalities of the wine trade. He comes to the Australian Wine Fair every year, and he always wears, in the middle of winter, a Hawaiian shirt. And he is just such a great character, but he is a brilliant winemaker as well. His winery is one of the most significant in the McLaren Vale, which is a very well-known Australian wine region. And he's the fourth generation of his family. And he took over winemaking there in 1984. But the Irish connection to this winery, which I think is fantastic, is his grandfather, Francis Frank Osborne, married a girl called Helena Darenberg in 1920. They had three children. But Helena Darenberg's family were of French origin. And one of her direct ancestors ended up in a duel with one of Napoleon's general. And the story was that if you were the underling, in fact, if you were outranked by the person who had challenged you to the duel, they expected you to fall on your sword. But your man decided he
wasn't
going
to... What's the point of asking somebody to have a duel then?
Oh, that was the way it all was back then. So he decided he wasn't going to do that. And he killed his commanding officer. The row was over a woman, by the way. And he fled to Ireland, where he ended up in Cork, where he married into the sort of merchant prince families. And in fact, his grandson, as far as I know, became provost of Trinity College, and they had a house in Animo, which is the house that John Borman lives in now. So, and then at the turn of the last century, the Darenbergs emigrated to Australia, and the Sump Jump is actually relating to they won money on a horse race, and that was that's what they started their business with. So that's where the name comes from, right? So they're a great character of a family. And the Osbornes obviously don't have the Irish connection, but the granny does, right? Yeah. Does your granny come from Ireland? Well, she does in this case. And so that's the Irish connection. And it's a wonderful story. And I think we should make a film about it, Esther. Anyway, this is their Sauvignon Blanc. And he sources the fruit from both the Adelaide Hills and the McLaren Vales. Very drinkable Aussie Sauvignon. Tropical fruit aromas, nice citrus fruit. Great. Do you know what? Marinated chicken and your barbecue. You're only man for the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this'll do great. $15.99, I'll get it and carry out.
Can't be bad. Janet says on Twitter, I remember graduate altar boys who sampled it telling me this is altar wine, saying it was strong. That was probably when Black Tower was the height of sophistication. Now, someone else on Twitter says, long ago when I was an altar boy, they used Black Tower.
Oh, right.
I would have thought they used a red wine, but I suppose you can never see it in the thing.
Exactly. I would know.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah.
Chateau Neuf de Papa for the Pope's Mass. It makes sense, doesn't it, really? Because it is the Pope's wine. Right.
I feel a hashtag coming on.
Oh, no, yes.
Actually, Chateau Neuf de Papa means the new castle of the Pope, because don't forget the...
But that
the
was like the fakey Pope when they were rowing over who
moved,
was Pope.
They just moved from Italy to Avignon for a couple of hundred years and then moved back.
Yes.
I know that much.
I have it on good authority that wine for the Pope's is mass produced. Oh, God, save us tonight. Altar wine, especially produced by certain vineyards, e.g. Chateau Eugenie in Cahors, who also make for the Russian Coptic Church, says Margaret.
Ooh, now, that sounds kind of true. And that sounds good.
Good answer, Margaret. Thanks very much. Would your wine expert know if small quarter bottles of wine that you get in the pub give you more of a hangover than a big bottle, or is this a myth? Well, if you drink four of them. I'm always dying after a night in the pub, and would always drink the same amount of wine from a bottle at home, and I'm always grand.
To be honest with you, I didn't even know quarter bottles still exist. I know they do. They used to be 15% of the Irish market when we had a wine market of about 9 million cases, right?
Yeah.
They can sometimes have a little bit more sulphur in them than a 75 cl bottle, right? And so that will probably giving you the hangover. But nowadays, most pubs, which have turned into restaurants anyway, everyone is a gastropub now. Everybody's serving food. And more any pub I've been in that I've been eating or drinking wine, eating and drinking wine in, have always served me wine out of a 75cl bottle. I don't think, I can't remember the last time I saw a quarter bottle.
No, they
apart
do have
from
them
on,
though, yeah.
On a plane, you know, yeah. So.
And they sell them in, a lot of supermarkets as well. You know, like, I not only know that because sometimes I'd buy one if I wanted to put it into something I was cooking.
Yeah.
And not open a big bottle.
Actually, I used to do that as well, yeah.
Yeah. What are the more decent box wines I can buy for the fridge for visitors? We're the only ones of our friends who have a decent garden, and during the good weather, the footfall was a bit intense. I don't want to poison my visitors, but I don't want to break the bank either.
Box wines never really caught on this market. I know they're huge in Scandinavia. There probably are here, but you know, I regularly go around looking at the supermarkets. The only place I've seen boxed wines in is Dunn Stores. I know they definitely have them, but it's not. We Irish love our bottled wines, so we never really drank the boxed wines. But try Dunn's. I think Marks and Spencer's might have them as well. Try the Dunn's or Marks and Spencer and see what they have. Yeah, usually it's great value, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's just a different method of serving up your wine.
Yeah. Gee, we're getting a lot of comments still about Mamma Mia. First of all, first things first, all musicals are rubbish. The idea of going to the cinema to see a musical, I'd rather sit in a septic tank and eat dead rats through a hole in a tramp's vest. Mamma Mia is embarrassing. Old plastic-faced has-beens pretending to be teenagers. How do their faces not melt under the camera lights? Compelling arguments. Thank you very much. I don't think that's your actual choice between going to a musical or sitting in a dead septic tank. There's other things you can do. I went to see Mamma Mia, and while it's not my thing, I totally enjoyed it and sang along. If I want to go and see a Mike Lee film, that's what I know what to expect. And if I go to see ABBA and also know what to expect, it's a no-brainer. For all of life fun lovers who loved Mamma Mia, unite and take over. For all the others, there's the Pope Francis later this month, says Mel. Somebody else says, I'm in my 60s. And Mamma Mia was so energetic with all the dancing. I wish I was 18 again. A great, easy to watch film, they say.
And a really moving one as well. I actually teared up.
Right, okay.
I teared up towards the end. I'm not going to lie.
Okay.
Because there's a whole story element involving Amanda Seyfried's character and her mum, who's now passed away, of course, played by Meryl Streep. And it's really beautifully handled at the end of the film and very, very moving.
Ah, right. OK. Now, we did get a fair amount of texts from fellas saying I was dragged to see it by the wife, stroke girlfriend, blah, blah. When I hear about these men being dragged to the cinema to see Mamma Mia movie by their girlfriends, I'm baffled by how these relationships function, says Michael. I would have nothing in common with someone who wanted to see that movie. Surely all these relationships are doomed, says Michael, who will die alone.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Proudly sponsored by Carryout, Ireland's leading independent off licence. Carryout.ie.
How did he even have time to buy a ticket? Just one time, please work! Yes!
Oh, all right, I need help.
Yes?
Oh, sorry.
Hey! Come on, man! Not cool!
Murderers!
Yes! Yes! I'm gonna call you Antonio Banderas! You're a badass!
There you go, that's Ant-Man and the Wasp, the second Ant-Man movie. So in the first one, there was a kind of a father-daughter team he was involved with. Are they gone out of it completely
now? No, that's brought up here again. That's Evangeline Lilly's character, the Wasp, who had a very, very small role in the original film, much more front and centre here.
Okay.
And her dad is played by Michael Douglas. And they are looking for his wife, her mum, who's Michelle Pfeiffer, who was, now, she's trapped in a place called, we've got to go into Marvel language
okay,
here, right?
Yeah.
She's trapped in a place called the Quantum Realm.
Oh, that's my favourite realm.
And she's been there in a tiny form since sacrificing her own existence to defuse a bomb. So she basically took a hit for the team
okay. And
has been trapped in this realm ever since. They don't know whether she's alive or not. We're talking decades here, so
okay. They
think she could be dead. But the Michael Douglas' character has kind of figured out a way to access the realm for the first time ever and see if they can find the mother, basically, Michelle Pfeiffer's character, who's kind of wasted here. I love her and I love that she's back doing movies. And she was the best thing about Mother, which was otherwise awful. But she's kind of underused a little here, but it's great to see her back doing stuff. And I think this film, like, that's kind of the objective there. And then he's kind of, well, Scott Lang, who's Ant-Man, who's played by Paul Rudd, is under house arrest following the carry-on in the first film. So he kind of did a plea bargain where he'd stay in the house and he's waiting to kind of finish that term. But Michael Douglas' character says, no, we need you now, sort of thing. So he sneaks out of the house and has, they're having a whole lot of fun with Paul Rudd being naughty here, basically. And I'm okay with that. I've loved him ever since he played Phoebe's girlfriend in Friends as a young actor, if you remember.
Genie.
Yeah. And he's great at physical comedy. And I think this is a little more, a little looser and more chilled than the first film in a good way, in that people are allowed to riff a bit more and be a bit more slapstick. And at the core of it all is kind of a love-hate relationship between Paul Rudd's character and Evangeline Lilly's character, which really works great because they are a bit mad about each other but are having difficulty expressing that. And there is a lovely chemistry and banter between the two characters in the film. And I think it really is the actors who saved this. I'm not saying it's a bad film. It's a very, very enjoyable film, but it's quite light. The story is a bit meandering. And it's a bit also, it's kind of both meandering and also has a feeling of being there before about it.
Okay.
Not differentiating itself enough maybe from The Pearl and the situations faced in other Marvel films. So I think it's the riffing of the cast that really saves us. And Michael Pena as well, the Mexican-American actor, he plays Lewis, who he was in the first film as well. He's one of the security team who are pals of Ant-Man's character, and kind of, he riffs off him and steals nearly every scene he's in, to be honest with you. He's very, very funny in it. Then, yeah, so we're getting two villains this time, I suppose. There's a shape-shifting character named Ghost, and there's a general kind of a nasty piece of work by the name of Sonny, and they're the kind of people he has to take on this time. But it's really, I think for me, the peril and the drama of it isn't really there. It's for me, it's the banter between the characters and the will they, won't they between him and Evangeline Lilly, I think, is
right.
Really lovely.
Didn't he have a daughter in the last film?
He does, yeah, he does.
Right, okay.
And she features in this one as well. She gives him some relationship advice, actually, quite early on in the film.
Okay.
Which is very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's it. Same director, Peyton Reed, back to helm this time. But just to me, the story was just a little bit dispensable and disposable, I suppose. But it's Michael Douglas as well, again, saving it by being kind of delightfully grumpy and being kind of slightly Michael Douglas. How did I end up in a Marvel kid film geared towards kids, you know,
yeah,
growling his way through the script to delightful effect, I'd say. And I would say this one is maybe aimed towards the kids more than a lot of Marvel's recent films. The Search 12A, but there's really nothing here to worry about, even with smaller kiddies. And I think it has a slapstick to it and a sense of fun to it that children will really buy into. And I suppose it's no coincidence then that it's getting released the August weekend here, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kira says, typical, same tone, same formula. Most of MCU movies, a trashy villain with lots of fun and sprinkles of jokes and humour, which is starting to get stale for me. Someone else says, the girl in the movie was in that show Lost. If that movie is as bad as the conclusion of that show I spent so much of my life watching, I think I'll pass. Someone else says, Paul Rudd was my teenage crush since he was Alicia Silverstone's stepbrother stroke boyfriend on Clueless. Before he was on Friends. Crikey, yeah. Like, he's aged well, that fella.
He's great. He's
very
good
well.
Fun. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him as well, and he's as mischievous in real life as he is in lots of his roles, I have to say.
Now, somebody else says, there's no such thing as superhero fatigue. These movies continually break their own box office record. Doesn't mean they are good, but it does mean there's no fatigue. Is there a point in that?
Yeah, I do. I think somebody joked on Twitter that they had Marvel fatigue, and I thought that was quite clever.
Yes.
Because we're all going on about it now. I'm guilty of it myself.
Yeah.
You know, I do think there are too many films, but I think it's really interesting. In the last year or so, I think they are Marvel and Disney are employing really good filmmakers, and the films are becoming distinctive and differentiated from each other, which I think is probably a stroke of genius, actually, that they've managed to do that.
Well, that's just before the fatigue sets in, I suppose.
The Marvel fatigue.
Yes, yeah. No, but if that text is right, there's no financial evidence of fatigue, but, you know, it might, down the road, there might be. So let's make them as different.
If anything, they're doing better. If anything, they're making more money at the box office.
And crikey.
Yeah.
My word.
And, you know, they're doing really well in what the American box office calls rest of world as well. They're not just American box office hits. They're doing well all over these emerging markets that we have in Asia, China, places like that.
John Roth Mines wants to know, there's been a lot of comparisons made between Ant-Man and the Wasp and Deadpool. I absolutely love Deadpool. How does this movie rate against it? Ooh, time to be controversial.
I'm not a big Deadpool fan. I just found that character really annoying. I couldn't warm to him, and I know he was supposed to be, and I know it was supposed to be subversive of comic book movies and stuff. I don't see much of a comparison beyond that, to be honest with you. This definitely has a whole heap of fun with the shtick that goes with comic book movies, but I think not in an inventive enough way, and certainly not in the way that Deadpool did, the two Deadpool movies did.
Yeah. Is there a regulation regarding decibel level for kids' movies? We went to see Incredibles 2 and it was insanely loud for our kids' ears.
I don't know, but God rest him, the late George Byrne, a friend of this parish and a great friend of mine, used to wear earplugs to the press screenings for Michael Mann films because they were so notoriously
very
loud.
Very wise move, yeah.
Very wise move. And sometimes when it's a bit bombastic at a screening, I always think of George. But I don't think there are any limits. I think they
probably depends cinema to cinema.
Yeah, and I think I'd often say for smaller children, the sensory experience of going to cinema, people would say, "Will I bring my 4-year-old to this, or is it too scary?" I would say, you know, bring your 4-year-old if they've been to the cinema before, because if there's a bit of peril going on screen and you've got all this kind of surround sound and flashing lights and all the stuff that
you have
goes,
to bring them at some point.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. But I would say bring them to something a little gentle first, maybe.
Yeah, but say our 2 and a bit year old loves Incredibles 1.
Mm.
So
she could taste.
So should we bring her to Incredibles 2 now?
I think she might be a bit young.
Do you think? Yeah,
I think she might. I remember bringing my 4-year-old niece to Fantasia when it was up in IMAX. Do you remember when they did IMAX on Parnell Street?
Yeah, that's now.
And they re-released Fantasia, and it was a big deal. But the screen was absolutely massive, and it was right in front of our faces. And it was only Mickey Mouse and stuff. But she said afterwards, "I never bring me to see that again, please."
Yeah. Well, Fantasia, I don't blame her.
Too much going on, you know.
People need to get over themselves about Lost and the ending. It was a great show. It had an ending not unlike Sopranos. It just stopped in the middle of a... My 7-year-old has made me promise to take her to Hotel Transylvania 3 this weekend. Is it as bad as I've imagined it to be in my head?
I haven't seen it, but I think they're very kid friendly, those movies. They're not going to set the world on fire, that's for sure. But I think the reviews have been reasonably good for it. I think the kind of high 60s on Rotten Tomatoes, which is the aggregate site, so you're looking at 2/3 positive reviews, but they are much more geared towards children than, say, movies like The Incredibles even.
Owen wants to know, have you seen Black Klansman with Adam Driver, and is it any good?
No, but it sounds really interesting. It's the new Spike Lee, and it's based on a true story. I don't know when we're getting it here, but it's been released in the US next week. I'll keep an eye out for Irish release dates. But it's based on a true story about the first African-American policeman in Colorado Springs who recruits Adam Driver's character to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan in 1970s America. So it sounds like a really interesting story.
And yeah, it does.
Who would you want to direct that except Spike Lee, of course? Yeah.
Esther, I saw a Quiet Place this morning. As a 50-year-old Australian male, I'm not afraid to admit that I had to keep turning it off and walk away for a break and cried like a baby at the scene near the end. You were spot on. It was brilliant.
Thought I was going to get given out to no, so no. much flack over that movie.
I loved it.
It's mad because I'm not, horror is not really my genre, but and you could debate whether to call either of these films horror, but like two horror thriller films are in my top 10 at the list so far this year, and that's A Quiet Place and Hereditary, which I also loved.
Anonymous Location Scout says, I didn't work on it myself, but all my work pals who worked with Paul Rudd on Moon Boy say he's an absolute dreamboat in real life.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that.
That's nice to hear. Yeah. I suspect I know who that anonymous location scout is. Going back to Mamma Mia, just a thought. Is there no DNA testing in the world of Mamma Mia? Somebody wants to know. Good point.
You genuinely have a movie, like.
Yeah.
People applied that logic to A Quiet Place. They said, why didn't you just have something really noisy far away from the house? And you're going, then you wouldn't have a film.
Michael also was puzzled as to why any woman would want to drag their boyfriend to see Mamma Mia, you know, etc. What was the dynamic there? Keith in Dublin 2 says, to your baffled listener, here's how it works. Sweetest, if you accompany me to Mamma Mia, then some jiggy jiggy will be your reward later. Boyfriend, yes. And a few people got in contact about altar wine. I think they use a sweet wine similar to Italian Vinsanto. It's a tawny white wine.
I didn't know actually, yeah, that sometimes they use sweet wine. I had heard that before, yeah.
Yeah. Brian in Limerick says altar wine is supplied by Lawlers of Blanchardstown. We don't know if that's true or not, though we did find a website that sells altar wine, and it says altar wine is pure wine from the grape containing not less than 15% grape spirit.
Right. So is it fortified then?
It's fortified wine. Yeah. And it's ecclesiastically certified. Pack of 12 bottles, €140, €11.60 each.
Right.
Not bad. We might review that at some point. One more wine, one more film after this.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Proudly sponsored by Carryout, Ireland's leading independent off licence. Carryout.ie.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Someone says, because we were talking about stump jump. Stump jump is a kind of a horse-drawn plough. It revolutionised farming in Australia as it allowed farmers to plough land that was only partially cleared, says the texter.
Okay. I know that they tell the story, or the pure people tell me the story, that it was to do with the horse race. That's, you know, that's in the blurb. So maybe I shouldn't believe press releases.
Lost in Louth says, I asked a friend of mine what she wanted for her birthday. She texted back and said a bottle of Barolo. I've no idea what Barolo is. Any recommendations,
Barolo,
please?
Barolo is an Italian wine from the region of Piedmont in northwest Italy. It's a very, very kind of pricey wine. And the problem about Barolo is that it's not for the faint-hearted. And if your if your girlfriend or friend doesn't really drink red wine or doesn't know a lot about wine, Barolo is a big monster of a wine that takes many, many years to kind of come around and soften up and be kind of drinkable. It's one of those wines that people will kind of lay down or, you know, keep for a few years until it kind of softens out and evolves. It's a wonderful wine. Some people love it, some people hate it. I actually love Barolo. I love that it's led by, you know, when it's old, it's got leathery characteristics. Yeah. It's got that farmyard stuff going on. You know, it's one of the classic, great, famous Italian wine styles. But again, it's not for the novice.
But if she likes it, then.
But if she likes it, yeah. But you know what? A decent Barolo is going to cost you upwards of 30 plus euro a bottle.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you ask Movie Babe if Of Gods and Warriors is worth a gander?
I'm not sure what that is.
Okay.
Sorry.
Ask your movie woman, what's the story with James Gunn and Guardians of the Galaxy? Is he gone or is there a chance he'll come back? Now, this is because he made some tweets. But there were some years ago, but even still, they were rather dodgy.
Yes, they were dodgy. There were jokes about rape and paedophilia, but they were 10 years ago. And apparently his sense of humour at the time was a kind of an over-the-top provocative sense of humour. So that was his rationale behind those. Poor choices, I think, of jokes. What's at the core of all this is whether he deserved to be fired and not have a career for something that he did 10 years ago. The cast of Guardians of the Galaxy don't agree. They put out a very passionate statement yesterday, signed by all of the core cast, including Zoe Saldana, Chris Pratt and Bradley Cooper, voicing their support for him and asking for him to be reinstated. It was a pretty long statement, so I won't read it all out, but it was very emphatically pro reinstating him. So I thought that was really interesting. Variety Overnight, which is kind of the film bible in the US, reported multiple sources as saying that Disney are currently not planning to rehire him, which means a whole load of nothing, really.
Yeah, of course it does, and unless we change our mind,
yes,
and do
exactly,
rehire him. Yes,
exactly. So I think what's going to be very interesting here is how much pressure an A-list cast put on. Because you're talking about business and money here, ultimately,
a lot
of money. And see how much pressure the A-list cast puts on and how much the studio would bow to that pressure. It'll be a very interesting couple of weeks, I think, to see what happens there.
Yeah. And we were talking about what's Alter Wine is. Dan Dan in Cork says, a member of our Sociedad Española de Cork told a story. In Mexico, potatoes are called papas. So when the Pope visited, a huge, vast bandera was made using the literal translation. It said, welcome potato. We should have a welcome potato sign here up in the Phoenix Park. That'd be great. Right, let's move on to our second wine of the day, Jane.
Now, our second wine is the 2015 Chateau Bellevue-la-Forêt. The AOP is Fronton. It retails at $15.99. You'll get it in carry-out and in independent off-licences nationwide. Philip Grant bought this winery in 2008, so he's had it for 10 years. The winery is about 270 acres of vineyard. It's the largest single privately owned wine estate in the southwest of France. And Philip himself, you know, as I say, I was lucky enough to have lunch with him about 2010, so about 8 years ago. He really knows his stuff about wine. And, you know, he's a successful businessman. And this is what he wanted to do, was buy a vineyard. The winery was originally founded by a man called Patrick Germain about 43 years ago. And the wines had been available in Ireland for as long as that. And then it's just the owner changed, and the owner happens to be an Irishman. So basically, Fronton is near Toulouse, and it's sort of situated between the Garonne and the Tarn River. Negrette is the key grape variety here. Now, Negrette is a black grape variety, which you'll mainly find in the south of France, around that sort of Toulouse area, Fronton, Oly, Gaillac, all that sort of area. The grape originally appeared in the region in the 12th century under the name of Mavro, which means black in Greek. And it was brought to France from Cyprus by monks, basically. You know, like that's how most of the grapes, the church spread the grapes throughout Europe. Negrette, this wine is made from 55% Negrette, 20% Syrah, 15% Cabernet Franc and 10% Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, the one thing that struck me when I just tried it, first of all, you could see it's slightly dark in colour. It's 2015, it's 3 years old, but there's already on the nose an awful lot of development. But when you taste it, my God, this is gorgeous. It's got lovely developed kind of licorice flavours, smoky, a touch of green pepper. It's very complex. Some red fruit. It's drinking now. It will last. It's beautiful. This is made to go with sirloin steak, as far as I'm concerned. This is your only man. It's Negrette. It's not a well. It's a southwest of France grape variety. But God, it's gorgeous. $15.99. That's Chateau Bellevue-la-Forêt from Fronton. And go out and get it and carry out and enjoy it with a big lump of steak.
Noel says Torres Esmeralda, 85% Muscatel, 15% Gewürztraminer.
I can never say that.
Was reduced to under a tenner in O'Brien's and Dunn's recently. Great wine, eyebrows raising quality for the price.
Yeah, Esmeralda's a lovely wine. Yeah. And again, the Muscatel is a very grapey grape. It's very aromatic. That's another grape variety that originates in Greece. The Muscat of Alexandria was the original parent. Lovely, aromatic, feminine, floral sort of flavour. Yeah, Esmeralda's good wine.
Somebody else wants to know, how do they keep the Alter wine from going off between masses? The bottle is opened. They don't use much more than a mouthful each time.
If it's fortified, if it's like a Vinsanto, they've stopped the fermentation by adding spirit. So that will last longer than just an ordinary wine. It's not going to last forever, but you might get a couple of weeks out of it.
I suppose, yeah. So that's a reason why they need to have it as a fortified wine. Right, okay, fair enough. Can you please recommend a wine to have with salmon?
With salmon, yeah. Mm. Actually, Albarino, we've been featuring lots of Albarinos lately, and I think that's a great variety that goes very, very well with fish. I'm not going to say Sauvignon Blanc because I'm kind of getting a bit Sauvignoned out at the moment. Mm. If you went to somewhere like Rueda and you went for a Verdejo, which is a Spanish grape and it's light and fresh, that will go very, very well with fish. Vermentino is an Italian grape that's very, very good with fish as well. There's lots of kind of unique grape varieties that you can find. Riesling, Riesling. I love Riesling, but it's a very hard sell. Austrian Riesling, oh, that is just to die for. And if you wanted something really with a nice acidity and lovely, gentle, delicate citrus flavors that would go well with a nice piece of, I'm presuming not smoked salmon, a piece of fresh salmon that you've just baked or pan fried. Oh, that would go so well with it.
There you go. Right, we'll move on to our second movie, Apostasy. It's called, here's a clip in which Chloe questions her faith.
People say things about us.
People are bitter.
Some brothers believed Armageddon was supposed to come in 1975.
It's okay to have doubts.
Do you know how it feels to think Jehovah is punishing you all the time? Do you think it's right how they make you treat me?
There you go. That's Apostasy. And actually, that was a feature of it when we did the interview, that the world was coming to an end and then... no, it didn't. But we've got a complicated explanation as to why it didn't come mm-hmm. to an end.
Yeah, yeah. Or as people of the Jehovah's Faith call it, the truth. The idea that they're the chosen ones and the apocalypse is coming and that they will be saved if they adhere to their faith. I suppose that's at the core of what they believe, you know. And I really, really liked this. I'll say it's not going to be for everyone. It's a very quiet, introspective kind of film. Some would call it grim. I found it really, really compelling in the characters and these three women and their lives. And it's a brilliant, brilliant performance at the core of it all from Siobhan Finneran, who Happy Valley fans might know as Sarah Lancashire's sister, Claire, in that series, which I know a lot of people are very fond of. She is brilliant here. She's a mother, an ordinary woman outside of her faith, really. She's works with a council. She's raised two adult daughters. The husband isn't on the scene. We're never told why. And the older daughter, who we've heard in the clip there, Louisa, who's played by Sasha Parkinson, is starting to question. She's going to college. We find out in a scene early in the film that she hasn't even told her college mates. So she has questioned the validity of her fate for a long time to herself.
Right, okay.
But she's starting to be vocal about it. Alex, who's played by Molly Wright, on the other hand, is so devout that she has a form of anemia, which is very serious, and has actually refused blood transfusions in the past, and got one blood transfusion as a child that she feels very, very guilty about, because, as you know, it's very much against the Jehovah's faith. She's so devout that she's learned Urdu to go around preaching to people of that faith in the north of England.
Crikey,
which is kind of amusing.
Yeah.
It's kind of amusing. And so it's the meltdown that occurs within this family and whether they'll survive their faith, and they're all questioning their faith. It's really, really powerful, I thought. And there's really three great, strong female performances at the heart of it all. And I thought it was really, really well acted. And I suppose knowing, as you know, that Daniel Cotto-Tiallo was a Jehovah's Witness in real life, and this is his first feature, you know that there's an awful lot of kind of life experience and accuracy and authenticity feeding into this story. But it's, you know, it's not, there's no car crashes or anything like that. It's not that kind of movie.
Yeah.
It's a very talky kind of character driven film, but it just sucked me in very early and held me, I have to say.
Okay, yeah. It sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
We're joined now by Niamh to tell us about some good things to do this weekend. Niamh.
Hello. So the 83rd Tinahili Show is going on in County Wicklow on Monday, the bank holiday. It's a celebration of the richness of rural Ireland's traditions, their people and its way of life. One of the most popular events at it is the annual sheaf tossing contest. It's not a sheep It's sheaf. So it's a sport that involves great skill, focus, strength and accuracy. It's to toss a sheaf made out of rushes, which are tightly bound together, and there's weights added to increase the challenge. A pitchfork is used to hurl the sheaf over a horizontal bar over the competitor's head. Three chances are given to each competitor to clearly go at the bar without touching it. And it's a big deal because they're going to be selecting a qualifier to compete in the Sheaf Tossing World Championships in Australia 2018. Also in Claremorris, another agricultural show is taking place this bank holiday weekend. Among the highlights are the old time waltz and jiving competitions, a truck show, sand sculpting, a dog show, a rock wall, a bouncy castle, Irish whip wrestling, whatever that is. We'll be putting on a number of shows during the day, which is not for the faint-hearted, I'm told. Alaskan Mill will be demonstrating by Sean Heenahan, a milling method that's used in the hills and remote areas of Alaska for must-see for chainsaw enthusiasts, apparently. So claremorrisshow.com for that one.
Good stuff. And Kevin says, finally, I want to see Mamma Mia with my girlfriend, dreading it. Ended up enjoying the whole thing. Even found my feet tapping along to the music, much to my surprise. And he probably got sex that night as well. So it was a win-win for him. Good man, Kevin. Right, that's it for us today. Is Richard up next?
Richard's up next,
his yes. His last day, because I was wondering, thought he might be in the pub already. Probably, yeah, half-cut Richard will be sitting in for Ivan just in the next couple of minutes. We'll talk to you next week. Have a nice bank holiday weekend.